Good morning. Good afternoon. This is Sally. It's lovely to be here for the Q&A. And why don't we begin with the mantras, the Om Namah Shivaya Gurave mantras. We'll just do those and begin with three Oms. Om. Om Namah Shivaya Gurave Satchitananda Murtaye Nishprapanchaya Shantaya Niralambaya Tejase Om. So, hello everybody. It's totally lovely to be speaking with you at this unexpected time, and we are going to just open up for questions. And I just want to say a couple of questions have come in that people sent to me personally because they were too personal to share with a listserv. I just want to say that if you have a question that feels too personal for the listserv, do feel free to send it to me personally. And today we're going to talk questions about the text or about practice. Who'd like to start?
So we haven't got anybody yet, but do you want to address the couple of questions I sent over to you earlier today?
Yeah, sure.
Okay, so we have...
I would be... Yes, go ahead.
Okay, so the first one came in is... How do we avoid becoming frustrated and discouraged and continue to have the energy and enthusiasm to engage with rupita samskaras that we feel trapped in no matter how much we try? And she goes on to say, some seem to truly resolve and become roasted. Some seem to continue to sabotage our lives at times. It feels hard to not just give up fighting against them and let them take their course, even when trying to turn them over and practice Ishwara Pranam. It seems they continue, and watching them wreak havoc and sabotage our life is a terrible feeling, or perhaps in a more fatalistic view, it is our karma that needs to be carried out, and we can't fight them. Question.
Okay. So let's do that. This question.
Okay.
Thanks, Deb. This is a huge question, of course, and I suspect it's one that many of you have. Certainly I have it. And I just want to say from personal experience that there are certain samskaras, certain patterns, let's call them, that I would say are core to this life's karma. And you will be working with them for a while. I want to say from my own life, my own years of spiritual practice, is that they do attenuate, and you often don't know how it happens, because to some very large extent, your continued practice of meditation and your continued attention to them will, over time, and in the case of some samskaras, it happens fairly quickly. In the case of others, what I would call the fragrance of them, the vasana of them, will remain, but in a much less destructive form. And you should start to, I mean, you say in your question that some seem to truly resolve and become roasted. So you've already had the experience that some have resolved. And I'm going to tell you that this is going to happen with all of them. So here's what I came up with years ago, and I'm going to offer you a kind of a prayer or a vow or a resolution that you can take in your own words and in your own time, and it goes like this. One other thing, one of the most important gifts of this kind of practice is that you start to be able to see the samskaras in action. So in other words, when we're unconscious and when we're simply at the effect of our vasanas and especially of the kleshas, they operate more or less unconsciously. So as we begin doing spiritual practice, and especially as we become more willing to accept the feedback that life gives us, in other words, to look at situations that seem to come up again and again, we start to be able to discern the pattern. So recently, I was talking to somebody who was speaking about a particular pattern that operates in her life, and this is not uncommon at all. But it's a pattern of not, and it goes with truthfulness, it's a pattern of not being able to completely cop to feelings when she's afraid that the other person will be hurt by her telling the truth. And, you know, this is a fairly mild samskara under certain circumstances. There are situations in which it's actually becomes quite self-destructive not to be able to say how you're feeling. And when she first started working with it, when she first started seeing it, she would try to kind of break through it by telling a bitter truth under circumstances where it couldn't really be heard. And then as she became more accustomed to working with it, she realized that one of the gifts that she'd been given through her practice and her, you know, her awareness of witnessing and of the compassionate quality of the witness is that she could watch the samskara arising and hold off on acting on it. So she would sit in the feelings, which were extremely uncomfortable, and allow herself to observe them. Sometimes she couldn't fully do that. Sometimes she would just be forced to speak or act or leave the room. And yet gradually over time, her capacity to see it as it came up became more and more reliable, and she began to notice that she was not acting on it as much as she had been in the past. So this is an example of how a samskara gets attenuated. And what starts to happen as you're watching it come up, sometimes not being able to avoid the compulsion to act on it, and sometimes being able to watch it and sit with the discomfort, is that you begin to notice that the situations which trigger it begin to become less. And what I have seen in my own life and in talking to friends and students about these situations is that the more you are willing to be the witness of your stuff, the more the situations that trigger them begin to become less and begin to become less compelling. And my view of this is that as you become freer to observe your own karmas, life stops putting you in the situations in which you're forced to see them. Because essentially, in the process of working at our karmas, the universe is not trying to punish us or make our lives miserable. The universe is actually trying to help us see what's going on. So I just want to encourage you to have faith that in the process of watching it, of seeing it, of noticing when it comes up, of being able to hold back, even initially, even for a few minutes, and sit in the discomfort of it without necessarily acting on it. Every time you do that, that samskara gets pulverized a little bit more. Now, there's one more thing I want to offer you, and I'd like to, if you're on the call, and I want to ask you to just hold this for a moment with us, and anyone else who'd like to work with it, please feel free to. And this is the issue. this is the way you do it. I am fully ready for this pattern or these patterns to be transformed. Whatever it takes, whatever I have to experience, whatever I have to let go of, I'm willing to do, because my highest priority in this lifetime is to transform these patterns and be free. So whatever it takes, whatever I have to experience, whatever I have to let go of, I am willing to do, because my highest priority is to transform these patterns in this lifetime and be free. Now, if you ask yourself that question, what you'll probably see, and this is true for most people, is that there are certain fears, certain, let's call them attachments, that come up as soon as you begin to say those words, whatever it takes, whatever I have to experience, whatever I have to let go of. Your fundamental fear of loss, or the ego's fear of being, basically the ego's fear of loss begins to come up. And then you get to see what it is that you're holding back with. So as you consider making that commitment, then ask yourself, what percentage are you willing to make that commitment? In other words, is it 50%, 60%, 80%? So I'm going to offer this again. Whatever it takes, whatever I need to experience, whatever I need to let go of, I am willing, because my highest priority is to transform these patterns, these samskaras, and be free. So as you say this to yourself, just ask yourself, okay, how much am I willing to work with this pattern? With what percentage willingness do I have? So, and once you decide that's the case, then realize that, let's say it's 70%. Understand that along with your 70% willingness is going to be 10 or 15% of grace that's going to come along with your mere willingness. So if you're 70% willing to go through whatever you have to go through to transform this samskara, then you're going to get 80 or 85% healing, which is pretty good. The more you're willing to commit yourself to it, the deeper the guarantee that the universe gives you, that Ishwara gives you, that Goddess gives you, that you can be free of it, and you can be free of it in an instant if your commitment is that great. You might be cleaning up the residue, it might come up for a while, but you'll find more and more that it's a tendency that you can notice and let go of. So I hope that helps.
I have another question.
Let's see if there's anyone on the who's actually live who has a question, then we'll come back to that one.
Yeah. I have somebody on the webcast that asked a question.
Okay.
So I don't have anybody that's raised their hands. If you'd like to, if you're on the web call or on the phone and you want to ask a question, hit star 2 and we can unmute you. But I'll ask a question from the webcast. This person has asked, I used to have an immense love for Jesus, God, and Guru. Now I don't feel them outside and struggle to find them separately inside. How do I worship a Guru outside of myself when I feel like God is inside and no longer separate from myself? And how do I grow to be able to handle Kundalini's Shakti and clearings? So sometimes she's more energy than I can handle, and I'm wiped out after or during our work. It feels like I need to be bigger, more expanded, to be able to withstand, allow, and handle her powerful energy.
Great questions. Okay, well, I'm going to answer the second part first. That is, I feel like I need to be more expanded. So you actually can, again, I sometimes talk about this in class, you actually can open up to being more expanded. And what I mean by that is to become aware of the fact that your subtle body is as much as both arms distance around your physical body. So if you can, using the breath, whenever you feel kundalini or the energy in your body moving strongly, see if you can use your breath either horizontally or vertically to breathe into an expanded space, say 8 or 9 finger widths beyond your nostrils or beyond your heart or above your crown or in front of your third eye center, and just imagine that the breath, and actually you don't have to imagine this because this is the distance that the breath travels, begin to feel that the breath, the exhalation travels 8 or 9 finger widths outside the skin barrier, and that the inhalation comes in from that place so that you begin to breathe through a larger body than your skin encapsulated physical body. And this will gradually begin to expand your sense of what your body is. And this seems to free kundalini energy when it's strong, or indeed, you know, the whole sense of your physical self, such that the energy has more room to expand, because as you say, that's what she wants to do. She wants to expand you. She ultimately wants to expand your consciousness to the point where you are able to actually feel that what appears to be outside is not outside. You can begin to sense the world as not only deeply connected to you, but as a part of your body. And this starts with just letting the breath expand through the subtle body. And I have found, and many others have found, that when there's a lot of energy moving through your body, that just expanding your sense of how big the body is will allow it to expand without it feeling like a lot of pressure. So, and also it's helpful to notice that where your fear comes up, because fear is pretty much always our first response to expansion, and just remind yourself, this is a samskara. This is not real. This energy that's moving in my system is working for me, has the intention of creating more beauty, more love, more goodness in my life, has the intention of purifying the contractions. So as you do that, you can begin to have a sense of surrender to that energy, which brings me to your first question, which is that, yes, when you're very aware that the divinity that you have been placing outside yourself is actually within, then you can begin to, as my teacher used to say, my guru used to say, you can begin to worship your own self. You can begin to worship your own heart. You can begin to worship the pure energy that you become aware of when you become aware of your own awareness. Because the guru is in that, and there is really... it's really not necessary to invoke an external guru figure or deity figure once you've reached that point. Now, I would say that many people, and I include myself in this, like to live in the double consciousness of the inner divinity and an external form of the divinity. And I would say one reason for this is just that there's a certain delight in having a second person relationship with the divine. You know, it's like having an invisible friend or a protector or a beloved. So many people who have a very strong experience of the self, of the divinity of the self, will also cultivate and experience a lot of delight in an external relationship. But it's from a very different perspective than, you know, than happens at first, because you're aware that that which you're loving is actually inside you, as well as outside. The phase you're in is a very significant and powerful phase, and you can give up external worship without any difficulty, as long as you're really aware of the numinous nature of your own consciousness, and remembering not to identify it so much with your limited self. So thank you very, very much for that question.
Okay, remember, if you have a question, to hit star 2, and we'll get you unmuted and you can ask a question. So I have another question, since we haven't had anybody raise their hands yet. That was sent in. It says, is Mahatattva the same as being established in pure consciousness? Pandit Rajani's commentary. Yeah, I've been saying that perfectly fine until right now.
I know.
commentary on the Sutra 19 seems to suggest that if established in Mahatattva and then can only experience pure prakriti, is that the same state that we have been discussing when one has truly attenuated or dissolved samskaras and is continually absorbed in self?
Yes. All the texts of the tradition have words for this state of vastness into which Shakti, pure consciousness, evolves in the process of manifestation. And in the Sankhya system, the word for that state is Mahatattva. And what it refers to is, you know, what is sometimes called the great mind, the mind of the divine. David Bohm calls it the insight intelligence realm. It's a very subtle spaciousness, which is slightly more contracted than the vast, absolute, transcendent awareness that's beyond everything that could ever be manifest. In the process of manifestation, it becomes what in Sankhya is called Mahatattva, the great mind. And our pure consciousness, our pure awareness, is actually a part of Mahatattva. So as we begin to establish ourselves in pure awareness, there's this experience, and I know that many of you have had this at moments, or some of you may be in it all the time, that there's just this sense that your awareness expands and you begin to feel as though you're part of a limitless field of awareness. And again, this may appear for a moment or two in meditation. As we practice, it begins to become more and more a normal experience, and we can kind of slip in and out of it. So yes, when you experience your awareness in a state that is actually free of the kleshas, you know, in which the kleshas are either temporarily or permanently attenuated, you begin to realize that there is only that. And that it's you, so there's only you. And when the Sankhya texts talk about experiencing pure prakriti, what that actually means is that you're able to look at the world, including your inner world, without any form of distortion or filter. It just appears as it is. And that is, at least in my experience, that particular vision or that particular realization, it's very often a realization of, you know, what Deepak Chopra calls the universe is a vast energy soup in which forms arise and dissolve, in which nothing is actually solid, and yet everything can appear as solid. It's quite an extraordinary recognition that you begin to have when you start to see pure Prakriti, because, you know, what Prakriti is the underlying energy that tends to take forms. And as you start to realize that this universe in its essence is in a constant state of motion, it's constantly creating, dissolving, sustaining for a while. And that's one of the very beautiful ways you can experience pure Prakriti. So yeah, your awareness will lead you into Mahat Tattva, the great mind, the great heart. And may you have glimpses, realizations, and deep experiences of oneness with that great mind. So thank you for the question. Now it's the chat. Okay.
Yeah. Okay, we have another question here from the webcast. Dear Sally, are there different stages of enlightenment, or do you reach enlightenment and stay there? Is it associated with a permanent blissful state, or do you still go through various emotions without being affected by them?
Well, the consensus seems to be that enlightenment is an ever-changing state, that there is no such thing, there's no end point in this. I have most of my information about the higher stages of enlightenment comes from things my guru said. And one of the things that I found most interesting and that is pretty much my experience at the levels of enlightenment that I experience. I have never had the feeling that I've come to anything like the end of it. You know, it's a constantly evolving process. But anyway, someone once asked my guru, can you talk to us about the state you're in? Actually, the question was, can you talk to us about the state that you are always in? And he said, the state that I'm always in is one in which I go beyond the mind, I go beyond the senses, and I swim in the ocean of bliss. And then he said, sometimes I come out of it, but I always know how to go back to it. And then what he would say is that the experience of blissful consciousness, and again, this is my experience as well, and I think it's the experience of many of you. The experience of blissful consciousness is always expanding. So it's always new. And the wisdom that you're capable of experiencing and the insight that you're capable of experiencing and the feeling of wonder that you're capable of experiencing seems to expand, sometimes contract, but whenever you touch it, the newness of it, the wonder of it is greater and greater. And, you know, one of the great Kashmir Shaiva sages, Abhinavagupta, whom many of you have heard of and read, would often say that the posture of an enlightened yogi is wonder. It's like a state of just continual, oh my God, open-mouthed awe at the creativity of consciousness and the creativity of this universe. So there's no end to it, which is sort of a gorgeous realization that this journey is a journey of constant expansion, constant wonder, and a kind of unfolding recognition of how much there is to be in love with once you've seen through the Maya that makes you believe that it's all separate and weird. Because within that separateness and apparent weirdness, there is this pulse of expansive oneness and love.
All right. Let's see. I have another question here. How shall we position our hands or use mudras during meditation? Sometimes it feels right to turn the palms up, feeling radiating energy glowing through palms. I'm not familiar with the specific mudras, so what would you recommend?
Well, the palms up mudra, which is, it's the mudra, it's actually very, very much associated with the mudra of letting detachment, letting go, you know, this sense of energy flows through your body, and then it just flows out through your hands. I like that mudra myself. The mudra that I use and that is generally recommended is Jnana Mudra or Chin Mudra, where you put your forefinger and your thumb together, rest your hands on your thighs, and you can do it either palms up or palms down. Having your two fingers together actually creates a circle so that the energy continues to recycle in your body. There are many people here and many people that I know who do spontaneous mudras during meditation. So sometimes your hands will form different positions. There are a couple of books that have come out in the last few years on mudra. And it's sometimes very interesting to look up mudras, a mudra that you're doing in this book, in one of these books. It's called, actually, I'm going to go find the title. It's sitting on my coffee table. It's a series of cards called Mudras for Healing and Transformation, published by a couple called Joseph and Lillian LePage. And you can find them on Amazon. So if you're interested in studying mudras, that's a good source. I think there are 52 of the cards. Pretty much any mudra that you might decide you want to practice. Chin Mudra for meditation, the other one that's very famous and also does the same thing. It kind of crystallizes and holds the energy in your body, where you place your left hand on your thighs in your lap, close to the body, with the palm up, place the right hand within it, and then touch your two thumbs together. This is the mudra that you see in the statues of Buddha, and it's the classic Buddhist meditation mudra, and it's very powerful. It's kind of like you're holding your belly in your palms. You feel extremely grounded while you're doing it. So those would be the two mudras that I would recommend. And I often meditate with my palms down flat on my thighs, again, which is a comfortable posture for me. And it's sometimes called the mudra of sobriety. Similar to the Buddha's mudra, it is actually a way of grounding yourself. You know, by bringing your hands to your thighs, you actually give some grounding to your lower body, and this somehow seems to connect you more deeply to the earth. If you have any other mudra question or any other specific mudra question, please feel free to ask it. But what's most important in your hand posture in meditation is that you actually feel that the energy is being held in your body so that it can continue to circulate and nourish your body during the meditation practice. So thank you for that question.
Hey, we actually have somebody in Vermont, I believe, that has raised their hand. So I've unmuted you if you had a question.
Hi, Sally. It's Barry.
Hi, Barry.
I can almost always come up with a question. So I have been very diligent in my meditations morning and night. I've even started to incorporate journaling, which feels great. And what I'm noticing is, besides the love of it, which has increased, and I knew you promised that, and it seems to be bearing out, but that I was spending time at night reading the sutra from the book with the help of the audio book, and then going into meditation. And now what I want to do is just to listen to Gaia chant it. And it feels so much deeper by taking it in that way. And it feels like I can surrender more to it. And so the question, I guess, is it okay just to allow, and I'm pretty sure you're going to say yes, but just to allow that process. Just to allow that process.
Totally allow that process. You know, let your practice morph. You know, there are going to be different ways that it feels right to get into meditation at different times. And I agree with you that that sound, that chanting, especially the chanting of a beautiful voice or your own voice, can do that for you. It's you know, this is essentially an oral tradition. So it came from the days when pretty much nobody could read. So the sutras were passed down orally. And there's something about pronouncing the syllables that totally connects to your inner, to the Shakti. The syllables will meet your inner Shakti and go in, you know, very immediately. So it's always good. You know, it's good to read them out loud. It's one of the reasons why I ask you to recite, to say them. And it's beautiful to listen to them chanted in a voice like Gaia's. So, yeah, go for it. Thank you, Barry.
And she's actually chanting those that you brought up in the last class in that.
Yes.
In that particular. Yeah, so that's pretty cool. Okay, well, thank you very much.
It's pretty cool. Thanks. Yeah, you're welcome. So, I recommend that recording. It's really gorgeous.
I just unmuted somebody maybe in the state of Washington that had a question.
Is that me?
Is that Vicki?
It's you.
Hi, Vicki.
Yeah, this is Vicki. Hi, Sally.
Hi.
This is my offering to these sutras because it's bringing up a huge amount of fear to actually speak out. So this is my truth-telling moment to see if I can actually put into words the experience. So that's a good start. I've already spit out a few things, but so thank you for that. For me, this kind of core of these sutras has always been the focal point of like a lot of my resistance to this text at all. It triggers this old sense of thou shalt and thou shalt not, this patriarchal, you know, just do this, don't do that. And then this overwhelming sense of like, no matter how much I practice, I'm never going to be good enough. I'm never going to be pure. I'm never going to be done. And so I have to kind of wade through all of that stuff. And then I come back to this place where the only way I can practice them is to realize that they are practices of being, that I can't actually do them, but I can invoke them and allow them to be. Does that make sense?
Totally makes sense. It totally makes sense.
Like,
and
because especially, you know, like you read about the nonviolent one, and as an American, I've come to understand that, like, just being an American these days feels like such a violent thing to the whole world that, you know, so I have to make peace with, again, like I said, these trigger my perfectionist tendencies and my awareness at this stage in my life that I'm, you know, you can never be good enough. You have to give it your best shot kind of thing. But like I said, this core of the sutras does this to me every time. So that's why this time I'm trying to approach it differently, throwing it into the lake and the fire here simultaneously, because as you said, I do want to be free from this and to see the difference between the perfection of the self and this mental thing that just can never be good enough because it's just the ego and it needs to get out of the way.
Exactly, exactly. And what a gift it is that we get to see it, right? You know, that it.
Well, that's why
I
decided to just throw it in the fire today and say, here it is.
Yeah, and I think, and Vicki, I think that what you're saying is something that a lot of people can relate to. I mean, you know, it's just a couple of things about the yamas and niyamas, well, especially the yamas. First of all, you're right. It's that what they're asking us to do is be our full divine self. In other words, to expand to the point where these qualities become so natural that we don't even have to try to do them. And
because we can't,
you know,
do them. That's the
because
paradox.
We can't do them.
Yeah.
Exactly. We can't do them.
But we have to practice
and,
not doing them.
But yeah, exactly. And, you know, and as again, as I think you know, I don't think I have to tell you this, that really the mere willingness to look at to look at your own tendency to lie, to look at your own tendency to use things that don't belong to you, to look at your own harmfulness, which I would say, you know, I do agree that, you know, it's very obvious that ahimsa is the core yama, because it's at the heart of everything. So
yeah.
And because and because we have these chimp ancestors, you know, we as humans have aggressive genes. We are naturally aggressive. So, and that aggression operates, you know, all through, you know, the yamas and niyamas, well, especially, as I say, the restraints are actually meant to counter the different tendrils of our natural aggression. And the complicated part of it is that, you know, that aggression has its, you know, aggression is in a certain sense a quality of Rajaguna, and Rajaguna is a natural part of the way Prakriti works. You know, in other words, we didn't have activity which can become, you know, which is assertion, which
right.
can become over-assertion, which can become aggression. You know, we're working with aspects of the universe that we're never going to eliminate. So the question of, you know, what is actually harmful, the contemplation of what is harmful and why it's harmful is in a certain sense all we're asked to do. Do you know what I mean? Just notice what hurts. Notice what thoughts hurt. And the idea of I'm never going to be good enough is one of those thoughts that hurts. I mean, if you
see,
look
that's the paradox. That's why I had to actually call in, because it's just, it comes back around to that. You're right. And that was just the realization that I had this morning, is how that non-hurtness makes you just have to keep letting go and letting go and letting go.
That's right. And you know, and remember the antidote to harmfulness is some version of compassion and forgiveness. So truly the antidote to that perfectionism is forgiving yourself for it, is having compassion for yourself for it. And if you're a perfectionist, that's not easy. You know, because
like, you know, you don't want to just like slack off, and you know, it's that wonderful, beautiful. It's what I've tried to do is filtering it through this non-hurtfulness back into itself. Realize that it's the only way it cannot be harmful is to offer my small, you know, the small, seemingly imperfect parts to the perfect part. It's
beautiful.
It's it's hard to.
It's beautiful. It's beautiful. And, you know, and I think that one of the most important things that we learn as we become, this is meant to be humorous, but it's kind of true as well. We become kind of professional spiritual aspirants, right? So much of our mind is given to our practice that we begin to be able to come up with creative work, you know, creative ways to work with our tough inner stuff. So,
right.
And that's a beautiful, that's very beautiful, is to offer the imperfect to what is free. And I have a prayer that I've done over the years. I offer myself just as I am, with all my beauty and all my ugliness, to the Supreme Self, asking that it be transformed in whatever ways are appropriate. You know, so it's like you kind of give your whole self into the process. And, you know, another one that I think I put it in the homework is to practice forgiveness as a kind of a ritual.
I loved that. Yeah, the three. Forgive. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. I forgive you. Please forgive me. Let's forgive ourselves. You know, we are the way we are for reasons that we will probably never know. And we're here.
Well, I'm listening to you. Yeah.
Yes. Yeah, sorry. Go ahead.
No, listening to you, I can see how the way it gets triggered is I get down on myself for not being perfect. Then I work through that and I find my own peace within. But then I see how I project it onto the world these days, and I'm just appalled. And so then I'm like, okay, let's see. Can I forgive the worst in you? Can I forgive the worst in me? Can I find that place that with compassion believes that even the worst in us is perfect and is working for the best?
Yeah. Yeah, and you know, and the way you understand the state of the world is going to vary according to your inner state. And I would say that the koan that we're faced with, I would say in all times, in all places, but it seems very strongly right now in the United States and certain other parts of the world as well, is okay, how do we stand for what we believe is right? You know, how do we stand for evolutionary justice and not live in judgment?
Right. I know. It's a sadhana minute by minute every day.
Yeah. Exactly. Because on one side is passivity and on the other side is rage.
Rage. I just go back and forth. And then you find that beautiful space in the middle. And you think, and you enjoy it for a little while, and you think, okay, God, this is it. And then I read these things, and they trigger my perfectionism, and then there's my rage at the world. And it's very helpful to see how, but that's why looking for an honest place to stand that accepts apparent limitation, apparent injustice, and just really never loses faith in the truth beneath them both. So, but this has been very helpful in terms of seeing how it is my own inner judgment and my outer judgment. I can see now how closely they're linked, even though I've tried to kid myself and been a vegetarian for 40 years and tried to do this and tried to do that. It's still in there. So maybe somehow in forgiving the beast that I see around me, I'll forgive my own beast. And are you able to just stay at peace in these days, Sally?
I get completely triggered, I actually, full disclosure, I kind of enjoy getting triggered at times. You know, I'm like, no, I can't believe you. I have friends, I have these conversations, I can't believe he's doing this. But because my commitment is to peace, you know, is to light, is to offering blessings, I will kind of indulge myself in the drama. You know, I like drama, which is, I think, one of the reasons why we stay in it, is because some part of us likes drama, and I've seen this about myself. So it's become a discipline. I'll let myself read the
foam
news
for a few minutes.
Yeah, exactly. And then I will go back. I will start taking perspective, and I'll go back to a sort of open consciousness, sending blessings, whatever it is that I'm doing in order to smooth the field, and just to realize that, you know, that in a certain sense, this world is an ocean of energy. We're living inside an ocean of energy, even in Kirkland, Washington, you know, which is even in Carmel Valley, which I where I live, which is, you know, a beautiful natural setting. There are still waves of emotion that pass through the field of consciousness, and we're a part of it. So it's going to touch us. We're going to be affected by it. And in a certain sense, one of the things that we can do as people with a commitment to, you know, to being our highest self, to seeing without the filters of anger and self-deception, etc., is that we can take in these waves of violence, pass them through our system, and really send them out as light. You know, we can do a kind of tonglen with all of this. Mm-hmm. And it actually makes a difference. You know, it's not someone what is her name? She's a psychotherapist who is a child of Holocaust survivors, and she's worked a lot with that level of trauma. And one of the things that she often says is that, you know, when you're willing to see yourself as a kind of a clearinghouse for trauma without, and teach yourself not to hold on to it, but to let it pass through and to give it blessings, what you are actually doing is healing, helping to heal the world. You know, and the thing is that if you're going to stay outside it and insist on being innocent and not looking at it, then you are completely ineffective in helping heal the planet, right? So
you so much. This is exactly what I needed to hear, because what I'm finally seeing is that where I was getting bogged down in this process was I would do what you said. I would, you know, step by, but I realized that it was my own self-judgment.
Right.
Where I was getting stuck, and my own lack of forgiveness for my own imperfections, where I couldn't let the motion really just move through. And I, you know, it's the old father figure, the alcoholic, high critical, endless, you know, embodied everywhere these days, that triggers my little girl trying to be perfect. But it's in this process that it does move. I can feel it moving, and so I appreciate this space, and I'm very thankful that I just offered all of this to it, because, as you said, it has to move. It is part of what is bigger, and we want to be part of the solution, and this is, in our own little way, this is how we do it.
Well said, Vicki. Thank you. Thank you.
Well, thank you, Sally. I really appreciate this opportunity and the class, and for holding my hand and forcing me to look at these, which I have really tried to avoid, because they just made me feel so small and so. But they're so beautiful, and I love the way they come back to no harm, and so they gently do. I realize you can't practice. That was the thing. I can't practice one without the other. Like, they just
can't
feed into each other, and they come back around. And then together, you can feel them holding you in a way that then you can say, all right, I'll just love these, and I won't worry about being perfect at them.
Yeah, and you know, one of the beautiful things about reading these texts and studying these texts and practicing with these texts is that they begin to come back and give you Dharma talks. You know, so when you're losing it, one of these teachings will just come up, and you'll go, "Oh, wait a minute, non-harming," and it'll catch you.
Yeah.
At a particularly significant moment, and you know, this is the beauty.
Yeah.
Of being a person who is humbly making progress on the path, is that everything becomes a teaching. Mm-hmm. So, and I know you. You very much live like that, so thank you for that, and thank you for being that.
Well, thank you for, like I said, this class, all of these classes at this particular time is a huge boon. So I truly can't thank you enough, but I'll just offer that one and then you can move on to the next person. But many
okay,
thanks,
yeah.
Allie, for all of it.
Thank you for jumping in, Vicki.
Take care.
Okay. You too. We have time for another question.
Yeah. So this person asked a question. You had just asked about, are you willing to experience in order to be free? And she noticed that her biggest fear is to lose her husband. And she asked, how do I get to the root of that fear?
Okay. So I would say that's one of the primal fears. The people that we love, the people that we're close to, the people whose lives are entwined with ours, become kind of extensions of our own identity, and it just becomes an overwhelming block. I would say, first of all, the chances, hopefully you won't lose your husband, and I don't know what sense you're talking about. Are you talking about the fear that if you transform, if you become the person that you want to be in the opening into freedom, that your husband won't be there for you? Or are you thinking about physically losing your husband? So if it's physically losing your husband, hopefully that's not something imminent. And, you know, that's a painful experience that we go through at a certain point in life. And that is also not as bad as the fear that it's going to happen. Because once it starts to happen, once it actually happens, we deal with it. And, you know, I think, you know, there are many people in this class who've lost loved ones recently and in the last couple of years, and it's a tremendously big deal. But it's also part of what we're given in life to work with. It's part of the way we live through the karmas that we're here to deal with. It's part of the way that our relationships with these souls that we've come into incarnation with. It's one of the ways in which these play out. And in terms of the other way that you might lose your husband or your loved ones through expanding your consciousness, then it becomes a question of to what extent is it necessary to hide your truth in order to maintain a relationship? And we never know when we begin to expand our consciousness what the effect is going to be on the people around us. Sometimes relationships do end, but I would say that normally when they do, it's because at some level we've chosen freedom over that relationship. So that's the question. What matters more? And, you know, that the fact is, my intuition is, if that's your question, that you're not going to lose your husband in the process of becoming more free, because your freedom is actually going to enhance his freedom. And we can't really know as these processes begin and as these processes continue, we can't really know how they're going to affect the people around us. But if we are really being true to ourselves and practicing non-harming, you know, which always seems to be the issue, there's a kind of a step-by-step process in which as your consciousness expands, the consciousness of the people around you also expands. And if it doesn't, then then, you know, sometimes your journey for freedom causes enormous changes in your relationships and in the lives around you. And when that happens, it's very important to recognize that it is what is meant to happen, and that what it means is that that particular karmic relationship is done for now, is done for this lifetime. And honestly, it doesn't mean that it's done forever. It just means that you made a choice for freedom and your world aligned itself in order to allow you to take the next step and the next step and the next step towards openness and freedom. So be fully aware of that fear. Hold that fear in spaciousness. And very often, as you do that, you'll realize what I'm afraid is going to happen is not going to happen. And if it does happen, something will open up that will allow me to take the next step in my journey. And this is where a kind of faith that is born of experience begins to be acquired from all the ways in your previous practice that you've opened up to the unknown. And it becomes easier and easier to accept the fact that the future is unknown and that the consequences of our actions are unknown, but that all we can really do is act with a good heart, with the intention of non-harming and the intention of being true to ourselves. And the universe is going to line up in such a way as to make these qualities larger and larger and larger in our consciousness. So thank you for that question. And I'm not going to tell you to let it go. I'm going to tell you to hold it in spaciousness and allow it to reveal what's behind it. Okay.
All right. I have another question here from the webcast. They ask, is chronic illness a samskara in the way of liberation that can eventually be attenuated and therefore cured? Or can illness be a means of liberation? Or is illness simply a consequence of being in a physical body?
Really good question. And I would say the answer is all of the above. Sometimes chronic illness can be a karma that you brought into this life. Sometimes it can be environmental. It can be the result of the environment. Sometimes it can be the result of trauma that you haven't resolved. And, you know, there's a very interesting book called The Body Keeps the Score, which talks about illness as a result of unresolved personal trauma in this lifetime. My own experience with chronic illness is that it's very often related to something that I'm holding on to that I'm not aware that I'm holding on to. And that as I start to, or as the person begins to really look into and let go of that particular set of samskaras, that without even knowing what the samskara's relationship to our physical state is, the physical state starts to release as well. So in terms of dealing with chronic illness, along with all the interventions that you can do, you know, the immune system buildup, et cetera, et cetera, and there are so many great interventions that we can do, I would say that it's very good to ask yourself, not in a way that creates stress, but really with a kind of gentle, kind curiosity, what might be the samskaras that I'm holding which affect me on a physical level, which affect my psyche such that my body is responding to these samskaras, these vasanas, in this particular way? And as you ask the question, just begin to notice the feeling states that arise and then offer those feeling states. And again, without stress, without laying a trip on yourself, just admit your willingness to let go of the physical effects of the samskara. And I'll just say in my own, in my own life, this has been profoundly effective. It really makes a huge difference just to hold the possibility that there could be an internal samskaric reason for an illness and to open to the possibility of it being resolved. Okay, so more questions.
Okay, I just opened it for someone in California.
Okay.
Hello, can you hear me?
Yes.
Okay, this is Steve.
Hi.
Hi, I was in the first part of the part one and part two, and my meditations evolved and got me to a place where I was by an ocean of deep accepting energy. And as I'm by it, I look back at myself and my volition that got me there and saw it as a physical construct. And as I was before this accepting ocean, I did not try to enter into it. And I was at the point where I was more or less placing myself before it as a kitten and waiting for the mother to come grab me. And at the same time, I also have resistance to my own growth and path. And I was wondering whether that represents a resistance or whether it is a place where I should wait for grace to come take me further.
What a beautiful question. I think that it's, again, in my experience, it's very normal when you confront the ocean, you know, where you, which might appear just as it did for you as an ocean of love and acceptance or an ocean of light, along with love and sweetness and awe comes resistance. And again, I think it's really a question of allowing yourself to stand by the ocean as you are doing, be willing, and just stand in your willingness, saying, okay, there is this resistance, which I recognize as a natural part of my smallness. It's utterly normal for asmita, for the individual ego, to resist melting. So if you say, I'm willing to melt, I'm willing to stand here with the resistance and offer it into the ocean, just that much.
Okay.
And you'll notice that a bit of it melts, and a bit more of it melts. And every time you come up against resistance and you stay with it, in other words, you don't get up from your seat, right? You don't devolve into thinking about something else. You just stay with the resistance and the offering that is being made by the greater self, and gradually it erodes. And, you know, there's another thing you can do, which is to do this gestalt thing with your resistance, which I sometimes like to do, is to just, put your resistance on a chair sometime in a different moment. and just have a conversation with it. Say, what are you trying to tell me? What are you afraid of? Just give your resistance a chance to speak. But in the end, we just have to be willing to be present with the resistance and realize that it's not really a barrier. The resistance also is made of Shakti. It's made of consciousness, and therefore it can dissolve. So thank you for that question, which I think it's one that a lot of us have.
Okay,
so
thank you.
Does that answer you? Is there more?
Yes.
Okay, great.
I also just want to express my gratitude for your teaching. Thank you.
Oh, Steve, thank you.
Do you want to take one more question from the webcast?
Yes.
Okay. When working with ahimsa, how do we work with situations that trigger old wounds that are truly hurtful? How to not betray my own truth or power? I don't want me to become a doormat to other samskaras, yet want to grow.
Yeah. That is one of the great koans of the practice of ahimsa. How do you open and not be a doormat, or not enable other people, or not use ahimsa as a way of expressing your own powerlessness? So, again, it obviously depends on the situation. And if one of the... one of the smartest things you can do when you're faced with a situation in which you experience a lot of hurt is walk away from it. You know, there are certain situations that we just don't have to live with. There are certain people we don't have to spend time around. If that's possible, I think that that's a completely okay way of working with hurt that comes from outside. If you're talking about memories, if you're talking about wounds that you're holding that are not expressed in the present, then it's very helpful to bring the feeling, the wounded feeling, up into your consciousness, into your awareness during meditation, and contact the goddess figure, the beingness figure, whether you imagine her or that as your back heart or as a presence that surrounds you, or as we were doing a couple of weeks ago, as a being looking at you through the window of your own witness consciousness, lovingly, compassionately looking at you, and offer the hurt into that place of healing and ask for healing. Ask to know what it is like to stand up for yourself in a painful situation. Ask to be shown how to skillfully stand up for yourself in situations in which you're hurt or in which there is potential hurt. Ask yourself, what is ahimsa in this situation? And I'm giving you kind of general instructions. To a certain extent, every situation has to be looked at specifically. So is it a situation in which I should just get away from it? Is it a situation in which I have to change the terms in which we're interacting? How much courage is it going to take to change the terms? And where can I get help? So there's, in other words, there's, so to speak, real world issues that sometimes we have to deal with in situations that where there's harm. What do you have to do? What actions do you have to take in the physical world in this situation? And then the question is, how can you take them in a spirit of harmlessness? Because there's always a way to do that. And it has to do with learning how to soothe and salve your own wounds, how to embrace yourself with the wounds, how to allow the healing energy that is always present in your field to come in and help you heal the wounds. And then from a position, from a place of being willing to hold and embrace the wounded part of you, then how do you act strongly to prevent harm in the next moment? So this is something that you can absolutely do when your first commitment is to healing the wounds in yourself. And then acting in harmlessness from this place of healing. So I'm going to just share a story with you. A friend of mine who's working very, very strongly, very, very powerfully with the idea of ahimsa and with the idea of living your life as service, she found herself working in an office with a very oppressive boss. And she noticed that her practice of harmlessness was making her kind of placate him and not really stand up to him. And she realized in the process of this that standing up for herself, making waves, confrontation was psychologically difficult for her, and that she was hiding behind her practice of harmlessness in order to keep, in order to give her a reason not to be confrontive. So what she did was she actually practiced confronting the guy and marshaled her arguments, and then found the place in herself where she was willing to let it all go, where she was willing to lose her job, where she was willing to lose the relationship, played it out enough so that she could go into his office and talk to him, and discovered that by standing firm with kindness, she was able to change the situation so that he was no longer bullying her and she was no longer kind of wimpily doing what he seemed to need in order to keep him from confronting her. So a lot of the time in working with harmlessness, it's very important to start with ourselves and to start with admitting the harm that's being done to us by not standing up to aggression. And once you can recognize that harmlessness also applies to you, that your first dharma is to not allow harm to come to your own delicate consciousness, then you can begin to deal with the external from a position of, I wouldn't call it self-protection, but a position of really holding your own, holding the kind of compassion for yourself that allows you not to assume that you can take more pain than anybody else. So work first with your own pain and then be very straightforward in speaking up to the harm that you see in the world around you or in your family. So I hope that helps. I know that there's many complexities in interpersonal situations, but it always does start with compassion for yourself. And then you can work with the other person firmly, but with compassion. So, Deb?
Yes.
Are we out of questions?
No. Do you have time for one more, maybe?
Yeah, let's take one more.
Take more? Okay. Can you offer any insights to the source of the vasana of impatience that seems to be getting stronger in me and in society? I'm noticing how often the feeling of impatience with myself and with others, even while being superficially patient.
Huh, yeah.
Great question.
Yeah, it's a really great question. It's a really great, really, really, really great question. Impatience is it's one of the permutations of aversion. It's one of the permutations of anger. It often has some pride in it. And a lot of the time, our impatience comes from our assumptions about time. You know, in other words, we become impatient because we feel that our time is being stolen, you know, because we want to get through something, because we are being impelled by a sense of urgency about one thing or another. So it's really very helpful to do some inquiry. Okay, what is it that triggers this feeling of impatience? You know, does it come up in me when I feel like my time is short, I'm trying to get a lot done? Does it come up when I'm being confronted with behaviors that I thought I was done with, and I would like to have been gone already? Do I get impatient with other people's, you know, repetitive behaviors? Or is impatience just the desire to just, you know, have everything already worked out without my having to make more effort? And coming to understand what triggers impatience is going to allow you to ask yourself how to use your impatience, how to work with your impatience. So with the uprush of aggression or aversion, a lot of the time the best thing to do is to just stop and breathe. You know, that the fact is that sometimes we're impatient for a good reason, and sometimes we're impatient just because we're slightly out of sorts. But the prana, the breath, can always soothe and harmonize us. And sometimes, especially in the moment, when impatience just comes up and you don't want to, you know, be governed by it, or you don't want to cause harm with it, if you can just be patient enough with yourself to give yourself 3 deep conscious breaths, and then pay attention to the space that arises at the end of the exhalation, it's very often then possible to come at the situation or come at yourself with a little bit less impatience. But if you remember that it's impatience is an aspect of aversion, it's a quality of anger, and that it has some value when it's pushing you forward in a situation in which you actually have to do something, you can turn that impatience into action. But when it's coming up as frustration, you know, as a sense of frustration because things aren't moving fast enough, that's when you want to turn back and breathe and open and just allow yourself to recognize the impatience and breathe it out. So thank you for that question. That's an ongoing practice for efficient people who tend to get impatient with the inefficiencies of those of us, of people around them, and with their own inefficiency. And because we just did this practice with breathing, let's just close with the breath practice in the minute we have. I want to thank you all for being here and for these questions and for the granularity of some of these questions, which really do address some of the actual nitty-gritty day-to-day issues with working with yamas and niyamas and our own tendencies. It's a step-by-step process that is sometimes very frustrating and sometimes extraordinarily beautiful as we watch the effect that our inner work can have on our own state and on the state of others. So just find yourself in a posture that feels upright and yet relaxed. And let your attention be at the tips of your nostrils so that you're feeling the breath flowing into your nostrils, flowing up through the bridge of your nose, touching the corners of your eyes from inside. Flowing upward to the crown. And then feel the breath flowing in, as it were, from above the crown. Flowing in with a sense of light and love and expansion. Flowing down to you from the center of the solar system. Flowing through your body all the way to your toes. And then flowing upward from your toes to your heart. And feel that your awareness is centered in the heart, that the breath is now flowing in from the crown to the heart and from the heart to the crown. And in this moment, make this offering. I offer myself just as I am, with all my imperfections and all my beauty. I offer myself into the heart of the great self, into the heart of the goddess, into the heart of that vast consciousness which is the source of life. I ask to be open to the love that is always flowing through this cosmos and whose deepest wish is for our awakening. And so it is, and so we are. Thank you so much. Have a beautiful weekend. Namaste.